Welcome, everyone, to the Exposing Scientology podcast, where we delve into what really goes on in the world of Scientology and Scientologists, and sometimes take side journeys into other organizations that display similar traits. My guest today is someone who has never been a Scientologist herself. She's a military veteran who spent many years as a counselor in the Navy and came into contact with Scientology when she met her now wife, Rachel, who used to be a camera woman and director of Scientology videos and events. So welcome, Michelle Adair. It's a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Hey, Mike. It's good to be here.
Michelle, nobody has much of an idea of who you are other than my little intro there. So why don't you just tell us a bit about yourself, sort of historically, to set the stage? You know, when did you join the Navy? How long were you there, etc.?
Yeah, I joined the Navy in 1997, and I retired in 2020, right after COVID hit, about 5 or 6 months after I met my wife, Rachel. I did, half of my career, I was an ABE. Aviational bosun's mate equipment. I don't know if you ever seen the movie Top Gun. Those little those little people in green shirts that run around the flight deck.
Yep.
That's what I did. And then there's huge hydraulic engines underneath the deck that catch those aircraft and they launch them. So I worked on those hydraulics. And then the second half of my career, the Navy sent me to drug and alcohol counseling school. Processes, it's basically a crash course of somebody who would, you know, take a college course, but they dumb it down, and we do like a year internship, and then we get certified. They pay for the certification, the Navy pays for it all. And I did that for about 11 years in mental health, where we treated everything from substance abuse to combat PTSD. I did a year in combat PTSD. I did a year in sexual trauma. And then the general is a mix, basically. So you do group therapy, but it was, I did residential treatment, and then I did an intensive outpatient treatment also. I've worked at Marine Corps Camp Pendleton, and I've as a counselor, and then I worked at Naval Medical Center San Diego as well.
Okay, that's a pretty good summary. Just before we go on, because I know a lot of people who are listening to this will want me to thank you for the service that you provided to the country. It is always wonderful to meet someone who has made sacrifices for a greater objective and purpose. And I think everybody in the military does that. And I think there are a lot of people in this field of cult recovery that do that. And so I just want to thank you for what you have done. And I find it interesting that, did you choose to go from being, you know, an engineer on the flight deck of an aircraft carrier to drug and alcohol counseling, or were you just basically told this is what your next assignment is?
No, the rate I was in is flight deck bound. So I was always on ships. My first half of my career, I was deployed all the time. So to work on that equipment, there's only Japan, which I already lived in Japan for 4 years on an aircraft carrier. Way out in the middle of nowhere, there's another base that had equipment. So it's really to get better orders. So I wasn't just stuck deploying all the time, and I could get my regular rotation in.
Right.
So a friend of mine was like, hey, you know, I work in Navy medicine. They're very low. They're low staffed with counselors. This is an opportunity. You can go to different stations. So I was like, cool. And she's like, and you can help people. And I'm like, well, you can't beat that, right? So I signed up and they sent me to school.
Oh, that's terrific. Okay. Now, I know from conversations that we've had separately that the military tends to treat people and mental health problems a bit differently than they're treated in the civilian world. And maybe you could explain that a little, because I think it speaks to your experience. And when we get to the point of talking about Scientology, it's going to help people understand where you're coming from. So what's the difference?
Well, yeah, there's a few things that are different that come to mind. So we don't have to deal with insurance and things like that. As you know, when you go for medical care, I believe people are going to treat you differently when they know there's money involved.
Right.
And you're a client. Where in the Navy and the Marine Corps and, you know, the other branches that we treated as well, there's, you know, something would happen and they would have to go. And then we could do modalities that were probably a little bit more intense, I would say. Mm-hmm. Not that when a civilian would go to a treatment facility, it would be just as intense, but the people didn't really get a choice.
Yes.
So these, like the EMDR, right, which is the trauma treatment that most of us did. There's all these other different trauma treatments out there. EMDR was definitely a huge success with a lot of the trauma we did. And
what does that stand for, Michelle?
EMDR is, it's been a while here, I have it written down, eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing therapy. And what that is you're tricking the brain, whether it's, some people will use their hand. I've seen people use their, like a light bar. I've seen people even hook things to the body that give kind of an impulse. But what happens is you're going through the therapy and it tricks the brain to look into parts of the trauma where you might have forgotten. Or it'll connect pieces. I worked with this guy who was really, really good at it. He was a commander. And he had this patient that came every day with chest pains, like severe chest pains. He would get in these situations where he would be like in the fetal position. And he was working EMDR with him. And what he found out was in Iraq, he was driving in a Humvee and he hit an IED. And when the tank had flipped, the steering wheel had hit him in the chest.
Uh-huh.
And as they were going through the EMDR and he was connecting these dots, he was like, oh my God, that's the pain I feel. And the brain didn't connect it. And then with all the trauma of his buddies getting injured, all this stuff, he'd actually forgotten a lot of it. Mm. And when he was able to connect it, the pain started to subside. And that's part of these trauma treatments. Like I said, there's a lot more than EMDR, but that was the one I had a lot more experience with. And it's just amazing to go through that, for these people to connect and be able to, these symptoms that these people have, they were able to work through them and not have them anymore, or not have them as badly.
Right. Is that the same thing that Prince Harry talked about on the Oprah Winfrey interview that he did?
Oh, did I'm you not see sure. that? I didn't know. I haven't seen Oprah in a long time. She's one of my favorites.
I think it is, but that's fascinating. So what else is different? Because I remember you making a comment to me about, well, the Navy or the military is more interested in getting people back into action. And so they will kind of do things that maybe wouldn't be done in the civilian world.
So the mission of the Navy medicine is to get people back to the fight. That's the bottom line, right? Whether it's the ship, whether it's the front lines, whether it's the submarine. So that's the mission. Not everybody goes back to the fight, or it might be the secondary, right? Like, well, they're going to process out. Let's get them happy and healthy as we can to process them back out, you know, into the civilian world as well. But the primary mission is get them back to the fight, get happy, healthy, good sailors and Marines back to the fleet. That's the mission.
Mm-hmm. I remember we were talking about something and you said, well, you know, some things that are used in the military, they may not be FDA approved or whatever the standard is that would happen in the civilian world, because the military is able to just, you know, they're not worried about anybody suing them. They're not worried about, you know, liability. They're just worried about getting the fastest result that they can. And so they tend to be a little more on the, I don't know what the right word is, but maybe it's either cutting edge or out in the rough, tall grass, you know, fighting their way to get somewhere that you wouldn't see or experience in the civilian world.
Yeah, so the stuff we use in the military is definitely FDA approved. Absolutely. We did do things very intense because, like I said, it was about getting people back to the mission. So, it, you know, it would be very fast. and very intense. But yes, you know, people in the military, they can't sue. So we were able to do that. We were able to force people into treatment because it was either, hey, you come to treatment, whether it was for the trauma, for, you know, just depression and anxiety or whatever it was for, but you had to come or you'd lose your career. I mean, that's the, you know, that was the gist. So we could do things a little bit differently.
Right.
But no, everything we did was definitely FDA approved. The military wouldn't, the military was big on numbers.
Okay.
So we wanted to use things that had high success,
Which
is EMDR. EMDR is proven, it's tested, and there's success rate numbers. And that's what we were looking for.
Okay. Well, that's my misunderstanding of something that we had talked about earlier. So that, you know, I wasn't meaning to imply that there was something being done that was improper. I was just trying to get this kind of sense of the difference between treatment in the military and treatment outside, but it doesn't really matter that much. Would you have any overview insights based on the 11 years or however long it was that you spent involved in this, just your observations about what you think is important, what you think is helpful, what you think works and what you think doesn't with respect to helping someone recover from either an addiction or PTSD or some other, you know, mental health issues?
Well, therapy is always going to be your best bet, working through what happened. Our bread and butter in treatment was group therapy. To have a group of people that have similar traumas, not the same, but they're similar, come together and just be able to talk about it in a group of people and be able to relate. What happens with PTSD is sometimes there's isolation.
Yeah.
You know, I notice with the patients is they feel like, oh, I'm the only one who's ever been molested as a child.
Or
I'm
yes.
And perpetrators do that. I'll shift from combat PTSD a little bit to the sexual trauma, where a lot of the times the symptoms are the same, right? But what we talk about might be a little bit different.
Yep.
You'll have these sexual trauma cases come through and they'll spend 30 years thinking they're the only ones that feel the way they do. And they're the only one, you know, and their perpetrators do that. And from what I hear from my wife and from you guys about Scientology is that happens, right? There's a thing where they try to convince you something's wrong with you, not them.
Yes.
Well, the same thing with these other traumas, with like sexual trauma. It's you. You're the reason it happened. You're the problem. And people go 30 years and they'll sit in a, and then you can bring these people into this group therapy session where there's 8 to 10 other people who are like, oh my God, me too. I felt that way too. And then all these, and then sometimes with people's emotions, how they feel about things, there comes guilt. Cause then they feel guilty about how they feel. Cause sometimes, you know, these perpetrators make it where it's not so bad. And then there's guilt from the victim where they're like, oh, you know, maybe I didn't feel bad the whole time and I should have, right? Because, you know, if somebody hasn't been through it, they can't understand, you know, there might be, you know, all these, there's so many outside variables. But group therapy, I think is the best from my experience in the military and what worked the best with PTSD, relating to other people and their emotions. And it helps people not feel, you know, so alone in it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I got to tell you, Michelle, the thing that has always been most beneficial and helpful to me in, you know, sorting through the mind fuckery of Scientology is talking to others who were in a similar position or who have had the experience or who understand what it is when you talk about some of these sort of unique experiences, because, you know, Scientology and some of these other very high control groups. I know I have some very good friends who are the big NXIVM whistleblowers, and speaking to them and others, the bizarre world which is created inside of the bubbles of these organizations is so hard to either explain or for people to understand that it becomes frustrating trying to talk about what you're trying to process, unless you're talking to someone who has been through the same sort of experience as you have. And only then can you sort of get beyond trying to explain everything and into, well, what is it that I feel about it? And what is it that I need to heal about? And what is it that I need to get my head straight about? And I understand that makes a lot of sense to me, that group therapy really, really does help, because it has been what has been most helpful to me, for sure.
So when I met my wife, she actually kept from me that she was leaving Scientology because she was afraid that I would be afraid.
Right.
So it's active duty still. And we had met online, and she was actually in Utah shooting for Scientology. She had a small coup. She was training, and something had fallen on her head. She had a TBI on set. So we were chatting and getting to know each other. And I didn't know, like, behind the scenes that she was trying to get a car that nobody would allow her to get without any credit. Cause she's just telling me, oh, I'm trying to buy a car. And me, I didn't think anything of it. I've been military my whole life, so I don't know like how the civilian side works.
Right. Yeah,
so anything she's telling me seemed normal to me. I'm like, oh, you civilians are weird. Whatever. Do your thing. You know? So she would like give me these little cues of what was actually going on with her, but I thought it was normal. I didn't know. You know, she's like, oh, I got an apartment for the first time. She got a room actually. And I was like, oh, okay, whatever. You know, and then she was telling me she was having issues with the lender. And I'm like, oh, okay. That seems normal, I guess. I don't know. but I did notice she had these symptoms when we first met with sleeping. She seemed a little bit paranoid about, you know, when we were out and about and things like that. And then finally, I think we were heading to her sister's house from San Diego. At that point, she a little bit later, she was living with me in San Diego, and we were heading to Laguna Beach, I believe it was her sister. And I noticed while I'm driving, she's like on the phone, texting, you know, just kind of being quiet. And she was messaging with her sister, and she said, hey, we have to pull over right now. She hadn't really told me anything about Scientology yet.
Right.
But she was telling me kind of what she was doing, like getting a car and a place to live. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'm quitting my job after 15 years. So I'm like, oh, okay. Well, people quit jobs, I guess, when you're a civilian. That's probably normal, right? So pull over. And she's like, hey, I have to tell you, I was in Scientology and I left. And I was like, oh, I don't know anything about Scientology. I think I saw a magazine once in a grocery store with Scientology and like Tom Cruise on it. Like, that's all I knew about Scientology. So I was like, okay, who cares? And she said, and by the way, they're following us right now. And my sister said they're parked outside her house. And I was like, and this is like 2 months after she's like quitting, and her and I've been together because we're in COVID now, you know, so everything's like fast forwarding and crazy town. And I was like, oh, they're parked outside the house. And she's like, yeah, I don't want you to be scared. And I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me? Like, that's whatever. And she's like, well, I didn't want you to get scared and, you know, not want to be with me. And she had all this stuff in her head that just wasn't, and I'm sure Scientology, you know, put that there. And I'm like, no. I said, you know, I was in the Middle East for a lot of years. You know, they used to brief us. We would pull into ports in the Middle East and they're like, hey, just so you guys know, there's some terrorist activity here. If somebody follows you back, you know, or they come to the gate, do this and this. And the whole time I'm thinking, why are we pulling in here? You know, but we did. So I'm telling her this. I'm like, it's cool. Like, you know, I'm sure they're not terrorists. They're probably maybe a step down, maybe, and we'll be fine, you know? Yeah. And then when we pull up, like her brother-in-law was walking down the street, because I guess he was going to chase him off or do something, because everybody was kind of acting funny. So this was where, because we're talking about group therapy, right?
Yeah.
And this was where I knew, because I don't have an understanding of Scientology. I mean, I still don't. We've been together for years, and I hear about it from you guys. I hear about it from her, and I still don't.
Right.
So for me to say I understand, I couldn't say that. So really, there was nothing I could do to help her. You know, I could talk about some of her symptoms with her, and she said that stuff was helpful. What really helped her a lot was she found Aftermath online. She was Googling and just looking into stuff. And I didn't really know what she was doing. And then she's like, hey, I found this aftermath program. She had talked to one person on the board and she was like, they don't know what they're talking about. I don't know. You know, she's like, but then she got a hold of you somehow. And she spent days on the phone with you. Yes. And she's like, I'm talking to this guy, Mike Render, and he's really helpful, right? And I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful to you for that. And you were asking like, hey, because you understood when I did. I didn't understand the money situation. I didn't understand that they had kept her from having credit and that she couldn't get phones and, you know, that she basically didn't exist. I had no understanding of the frustration she was actually going through. She's telling me this stuff like nonchalantly, but it was a bigger deal. And I didn't know that the whole time I'm sitting right next to her and we're living together. And I didn't know what a big deal this stuff was.
Right.
But her talking to you was so therapeutic for her because I saw some of her symptoms getting better. But just to talk to another victim and being able to work through what you guys had been through and say, oh, no, Scientology was wrong with this. You know, when they put this on us, that wasn't true because I didn't understand any of that. I couldn't help her.
Yes.
11 years of mental health. And most of what she was, some of it I could, but most of it I couldn't help her with because I just didn't understand. And I think the days and hours she spent talking with you, you know, through the Aftermath Foundation was amazing. That she healed more than I've seen her heal at all. And we didn't need the other stuff. You know, you'd said, hey, you know, we help with money. We help with whatever you need. And we didn't quite need that because I was still active duty.
Right.
And then COVID hit, nobody had jobs. So we figured it out.
I know it's funny because when I'm talking to Rachel, I'm saying to her, because she's telling me about, you know, this problem and that problem. And I'm like, well, we can help you with that. And she said, no, I'm fine. And I'm like, really? Because she wasn't also telling me a whole lot about what her relationship was with you at the time. And, you know, I didn't care. I didn't want to delve into her personal life about who she's living with and what she's doing. Eventually that all came, but I was like, Rachel, you know, we can help you. That's what we're here for. And I think that as you say, the fact of having someone who understood a lot of what she had been through, because I had been in the same circumstances and dealt with the same people and David Miscavige and been to events and all the things that she would talk to me about. And I go, oh yeah, I know when the rehearsal happened, this is what went down. And she, yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And you know, when I went here, this is exactly what they did. Right. Yes, that's exactly. And I think that, like we were talking about, when you have someone that is able to understand and you are not having to spend your entire effort to explain things that are so unexplainable that you get to actually talk about what happened rather than explain the circumstances of how you got there. It's very helpful. And she is someone who just stood up right away. She is very brave, Michelle. She stood up right away and said, okay, I can't do this anymore. I'm out of here. I think this is wrong. And that takes real strength to get away from that sort of control, because the level of control that Scientology exerts on people is enormous and very, very difficult to understand.
Well, that was a part of what I think you also helped her with. You know, she got away. She got herself safe, you know, as safe as she could. I guess they were following us.
Yeah.
But she got away. She needed something else, and you were able to connect her. And I don't know if I can. You have to edit this out, I guess.
No, you can say whatever you want.
You connected her to the right FBI agents right away.
Right.
She knew she couldn't come public. And again, that's more stuff I hadn't understood. And she was trying to explain it to me. She's like, oh, they'll open a website with my name that says I'm a child molester. Because we were in the process of actually getting foster kids at the time.
Right.
So every step of the foster care process, we had to explain to them about Scientology and what they're going to do, you know, just for safety purposes. Yeah, you connected her with people where she could really, because she wasn't able to just come out and and tell people, hey, this is happening in Scientology. She just wasn't able to do it. It wasn't safe for her, us, or our kid. And yeah, you really helped her with that. She was able to go in private and tell these investigators everything she knew. And you know, they, and she needed that. She really did need that.
Well, I'm very happy that things have turned out as well as they have, and that you have a happy life together now, and she's doing so well, and you know, she's flourishing now in her world of her unique skill. I mean, she is a very, very talented person, and I'm
ridiculously talented.
I'm so glad that she is doing well now and has sort of come out the other side in a new life, really. Like, it, when you leave Scientology, particularly when you leave the C organization, you are starting an entirely new life. Just as when you left the military, your transition into the world outside the military is quite a drastic change. It's even more drastic coming out of the C organization than the military, because, you know, the C organization restricts, like you were saying, you know, have credit cards. Some people don't have driver's licenses. They don't have bank accounts. Like, the worldly experience of C Org members is in many cases next to none. And particularly those who are children raised in Scientology that come into the C organization at a very young age, those people are so unworldly and so inexperienced in the world that it is very, very difficult for them to get out. And that's what the Aftermath Foundation is for, to help people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. You guys are like the piece of the VA that I get to have. The difference is that the military is super supportive. Because it was scary getting out. It was, you know, that was my entire adult life.
Yeah.
It was military. And I didn't understand anything else except military and how things work. But I think the huge difference is, you know, I get out and I get my retirement. You know, if I have some disabilities, I get a little bit of money for that. If they injured me or any injuries later in life that come from those injuries, I have healthcare for that. I go to the VA. I tell them whatever. I can tell them, you know, if I start having mental health issues down the road because of something that happened in the military. I get
treated.
It's all free and it's all taken care of. Where the, you know, and the Scientology is not like that. Rachel used to tell me that Scientology prided themselves on trying to be like the military. But then everything she would say, I was like, that's not the military. That is the opposite of the military. So when her parents passed away, who she was extremely close to, they kept her overseas. She didn't get to go and be with them or do things, take care of things she needed to take care of. And that's 100% the opposite of the military. If I'm in country and my sailor's mom dies, we are doing everything in our power. If they don't have a plane ticket, we're getting them a plane ticket. If they don't have money, we're getting the money for that. They will be home within, you know, a period of time that makes sense from being, you know, in the Middle East. And they will be there for funerals. They'll be there if they're dying. They'll be there for all that stuff. And Scientology does not do that. My wife suffers today from that experience.
I know. And it's happened to so many people, Michelle. It's like the tragedy of how Scientology treats familial connections is probably the most engrossing and all-encompassing abuse of Scientology. Like, there's all sorts of abuses that go on. There's financial abuse, there's physical abuse, there's mental abuse, but this destruction and havoc that is wreaked on families, not just from disconnection, or the disconnection is the worst of it, where you are forced to estrange yourself from people that Scientology doesn't like or says are bad, but also the idea that, and it comes from a very fundamental Scientological belief, actually, that you are a spirit, not a body. And your body and, you know, this lifetime are not really that important. The person who is your mother this lifetime might be your daughter in a future lifetime, or may have been your sister in a previous lifetime. Familial connections are very, very flimsy in Scientology. It's not considered to be that important. It's the spirit that is important, not the body. So the idea that, you know, someone, there is an urgency to go to a funeral or to be with someone who is dying, is in the Sea Org, is like, that's a zero priority. Literally, it is like, why do you care about that? I mean, they're just going to go off and get another body. You don't need to be bothered about that. What are you going to do? Just go say goodbye? Like, big deal. We've got more important. We've got a whole planet that we are having to deal with here that we're trying to clear. And that lack of empathy and lack of understanding of the trauma, the scars that that causes on people, it is really, really sad. I mean, I had that experience too, Michelle. My mother was dying and I went to Australia to see her. She was in a nursing home. I went to Australia to see her, and Scientology had sent her to another city so that I wasn't able to see her when I arrived, because they had PIs, they were following me, they knew where I was, they knew where I was going, and I never got to see her. And when she died, nobody even told me.
Yeah.
You know, it's devastating. It's terrible, and it's something that you can't, like, it doesn't go away. That feeling that you have when you even talk about this sort of stuff, it doesn't, I mean, to some extent, time does dissipate these things, but it doesn't take it away. It doesn't take the loss and the sense of loss and the grief and upset away. And this is why, in large part, I continue to speak out and try and do the work to put an end to this crap, because it really, really is hurtful to people.
Yeah, and that's all part of the abuse, the isolation from family. I know when Rachel and I first got together, she would tell me some of this stuff that they would do and they would try to get people to do. And she had no idea it was abuse.
Right.
She's like, oh, yeah, you know, they would teach people to trap people, like to use your body to keep people from leaving. And I told her, I said, you can prosecute somebody for that. That is domestic violence.
Right.
If you're in a domestic violent home and the other person blocks you from leaving, that is part of the abuse and part of the violence. You can't do that. And she said that was normal. That was what you're supposed to do. The isolating with taking the cell phones. That's if you're in a, because I also did a lot of our patients, because it was sexual trauma, they were also involved in domestic violence.
And right.
So we had people in like group therapy that actually had active domestic violence cases, and we would take them to their court appointments and things like that. And a lot of that would happen. The abusers would take their cell phones. They wouldn't let them talk to their families. So really they mirror, Scientology really does mirror a domestic violent perpetrator trapping and controlling somebody. That's exactly what you've just described to me and what I've heard over and over again from people in a domestic violent home.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's funny. The I've written or sort of taken a series of excerpts from this wonderful book that I read and sort of use as my Bible, because it had such impact on me when I first read it after I left, by Dr. Martha Stout, who's a Harvard psychiatrist. And she wrote this book called The Sociopath Next Door. And I took a bunch of quotes from the book and gave my sort of view about them and how it equates to Scientology. And, you know, I've studied a lot, you know, also about narcissistic personality disorder and other things like that. And I have come to the conclusion that the writings of L. Ron Hubbard and the beliefs and practices of Scientology are a reflection of creating a narcissistic or sociopathic organization. That I don't know that there is really such a thing. You know, it's personality disorders, and so therefore it is what a, you know, how a person acts and what their reaction and actions are. But if you look at what Scientology teaches people and how it inculcates them into certain patterns of behavior and action by reason of the teaching, but also by reason of the group peer pressure, it creates a narcissistic environment or a sociopathic environment where people are being mistreated by this sort of organism that is acting like a person who is an abusive personality, except it's an abusive organization that has all these characteristics of the narcissistic personality or the sociopathic personality, and it is bearing down on the people within Scientology all the time, and they are victims of this and act like victims of a narcissist or a sociopath. And it's really, really sort of been very enlightening to me to study more about this and try and figure it out and kind of come to some conclusions about what's going on and why is this so harmful.
Yeah, it's definitely you know, a lot of it's about power and control. I think even when L. Ron Hubbard was writing it, even listening to you talk about his writings and listen to my wife, you know, he was, you know, he's not a good man, horrible man, obviously smart, unfortunately.
Yes.
And he, I think his writings were placed there for specific reasons. I think he thought them out and he knew about power and control and what needed to go in that doctrine. Yeah. I think even way back years ago when he wrote it, he, you know, he had a, this narcissistic environment that you're talking about, which is, you know, to maintain power and control over people. Definitely. That's how he wrote that.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So now that you have, you know, spent time with Rachel and talking to other people who've been involved in this and given your experience and what you have learned from all those years of treating victims, do you have any advice that, or, you know, words of wisdom to impart about, like, if someone walked up to you today, Michelle, and said, okay, you know, I got involved in Scientology, but I'm starting to wonder about what, you know, is everything, you know, what would your advice be to that person?
Run. Run fast. Run as fast as you can.
I love it. I wasn't expecting that answer, but that's a perfect answer.
Are you talking about like they've been involved for a while and they've started to feel the effects, like the symptoms of
yes, like trauma? What advice would you give to someone under those circumstances?
Well, I'd first take my phone because they probably don't have a phone, and I'd call Aftermath and I'd say, call these people because they're going to help you with maybe some financial stuff, hopefully. But in the long run, I would say, you know, I'd think they would need some intensive therapy, whether it was individual. I don't think there's a group therapy for Scientology. I'm not 100% sure. There needs to be therapies. I think it would be very healing, you know, with a probably non-Scientologist facilitator.
Yep.
But I would, you know, trauma treatment, EMDR, you know, I say it all the time. My wife hears it like all the time. It's not a fix all, but it helps. I believe EMDR helps the best for most, is what I believe. I don't think it helps everybody 100%.
Yeah.
But some sort of trauma treatment, because that's not the only one. I think, you know, talk therapy is great. It does help with trauma. But to really get in the weeds, you need to talk to somebody who specializes in trauma.
That's
what it is. You know, if you call it anything else, you're not calling it the right thing. You know, that organization traumatizes people. That's the bottom line.
Yeah. It's interesting you say that, because I know that from my experience and my wife's experience and some of our friends who, you know, are former Sea Org members experience, you have to, if you are going to get therapy, you have to find someone who understands trauma. It is not just walk into any old therapist's office and think that you're going to get anything helpful if they're not already very well versed in the subject of trauma. And, you know, from my experience, if you can find someone that has some experience with dealing with former Scientologists in particular and trauma, that is where you want to go, because I've also seen quite a number of people who have realized that they need some therapy or some help and have reached out to get help from someone that isn't really specialized in this field. And because they then don't get anything beneficial out of it, they go, well, this is not, I'm never going to get anywhere with this. This is not for me. And it feeds right into the, you know, Scientological mindset that all therapy and all psychiatrists and all psychologists are evil implanters who are put on this earth to enslave mankind. And I just sort of want to give a pitch to people from my experience now that if you need help, find someone who has experience in the field of trauma, and if you can, experience in the field of Scientology in some way or another. And actually, the Aftermath Foundation, we have people like that that we can help put others in contact with that we've found have been, you know, helpful and understanding and knowledgeable enough to be of assistance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Is there any advice that you would give someone who finds themselves in the same position that you found yourself in? You know, you had Michelle meets Rachel. Rachel is now an escaping Sea Org member. You're now in a relationship with her. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with someone who, you know, based now on your experience, do you have any tips for people on what to do?
Well, I mean, how our relationship rolled out, you know, I already said talking to you was helpful. She's really smart, you know, and she knows how to use Google really good, right? She was able to find the Aftermath, but I didn't understand it. There's not a lot I could help her with. I didn't, you know, she's like, oh, I quit my job after 15 years. I really thought that's all she did was quit her job at Scientology and that's not true. It's a lot different. Yeah. I don't think anybody could understand when they got with somebody except to talk to the Aftermath. I guess if I knew about you guys, I could have asked more and connected you guys.
Right.
No, it's really hard unless you understand Scientology and what it is. I do think you guys get the word out to more people, to where maybe if somebody listens to you or Leah Remedy or all these, you know, other people that are doing these podcasts. I think if I was, because I have friends that aren't married to somebody in Scientology that I've known for years and listened to your podcast. It was crazy. Right. I called them and was like, hey, Rachel's going to be in a podcast with Mike Rinder. And they're like, oh, we listened to that guy. We love him. And I'm like, what? What do you know about Scientology? And they're military also. So they never heard of Scientology. And they're like, oh, that's just interesting. You know, we can't believe it. You know, and I think a lot of it stems back to when you and Leah did the show on Netflix.
Right.
That really got a lot of people's to be educated about it.
Right.
So I think people have that basic knowledge of watching the Netflix. I think then they could maybe guide somebody in the right direction, who to call.
I was sort of looking for something a little else than just that. And let me explain myself a bit better. I have found in my experience of talking to people that there are a few rules that I sort of follow in trying to help them navigate wherever it is that they're going to end up going. And one of those things is to try and always be understanding and not judgmental.
Yeah.
That it's really easy to be judgmental, even for someone like me, and look at a person and go, well, I don't know how you can still think that. And then I go back and I go, well, I did. You know, I thought that for a hell of a long time. And, you know, just because someone told me that that wasn't true didn't mean that I stopped believing it right away. And secondly, I try very hard not to tell people what they should do. I try and tell them about my experience and the experience of others and leave the decision-making about how they proceed to themselves, because I really believe that if you try and tell people that this is how you must now, this is what you must now do, here is what, you know, here's what I'm expecting you to do, here is what is the right thing to do, any of those sort of things result ultimately in potentially having the person feel like they've been misled again. Like they are so used to having people tell them this is what you must and must not do that I'm always super, super, or try to always be super, super careful to not do that.
Yeah, and to that's say, a hard skill.
It is hard. It's very hard because you feel like you see everything way more clearly than they do now. And you were back where they are sometime previously. And it'd be really easy to just say, look, eventually this is what's going to happen. And if you do this and this and this, this will happen and blah, 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 blah. And that's not always true. Every person's experience is different. And every person has a different approach to dealing with things. And have, you know, unless you've literally walked in their shoes, you don't know all of the dynamics and impact and things that are going on in their life that influence their decision making. And so I've always tried to be as best I could. Look, here is what I know. Here is what I have experienced. Here is what I've seen others experience. But you're going to have to find out for yourself. You're going to have to figure this out for yourself and decide what you think is the right thing to do and what you think your next step is. And I have found that to be that and being non-judgmental to be sort of the two most valuable tips that I have to give anyone. How do you deal with someone who is finding their way out or potentially finding their way out of the mind maze of Scientology?
Yeah, absolutely. That's part of the training we also received, because people don't respond to advice giving as much as they do to connecting on a personal level with a story of what you went through. 100%. Yeah. Yeah, that was like part of our training, like therapy 101 when we went through, you know, nobody wants you to knife hand them and tell them this is what you need to do.
Right.
Because not only does that set them up for blaming. So if it doesn't go the way they want it to go, they blame you and they don't take personal responsibility for, you know, a decision or just that was just the outcome that happened to happen. They need to figure something else out.
Yeah.
You know, cause them to waste a lot of time with the blaming. But yeah, 100% what you're saying. Try to relate to somebody with your own experiences. Use I statements. Yeah. The feeling judged, I think that's part of what made Rachel wait a couple months to tell me about Scientology.
Yes.
You know, she kept that to herself when she had obvious symptoms, you know, with the sleep and the being paranoid, needing to talk to you for hours, you know, like, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, you need to talk to this guy. Okay. You know, I think that fear of judgment is what kept her isolated from me as well, to an extent.
Yeah. I mean, the fear of judgment, and along with that fear comes the fear of losing someone that you have now managed to find, who is, well, obviously someone that she wanted to be with because you're married now. You know, and that fear, when you've gone through an experience of losing everything that you had, like when Rachel walked out of left the Sea Org, she basically walked away from everything in her life. That's what you do when you leave the Sea Org. You walk away from everything, and to then find someone who she wanted to be in a relationship with, it is a scary proposition to think that, well, if I tell Michelle about this, I might lose her.
Oh, yeah. She 100% felt that way, because I didn't understand. I'm like, why didn't she just tell me? Like, it's not a big deal to me. But I had no idea what a big deal it was. So I totally understand. And then she's explaining to me exactly what you just said, you know, years ago when I really didn't understand. I mean, I still don't fully understand, but I have a better idea. You know, she had nobody. All her friends had to were my friends now, you know, which were these like Navy assholes. You know, she's like, how do you handle these guys talking this way? I'm like, oh, just ignore them. Like, whatever, you know. I mean, she really had to learn, just have a whole different everything. I mean, exactly what you're saying. I don't even know how to describe it. But yeah, she had nothing, everything of mine, friend-wise, relationship-wise, you know. She was fortunate enough, and I don't think most people have this. She had a brother and sister that were not in Scientology.
Yes.
She had that going for her. And I think most people don't. I think that's horrible. So she was able, and they actually understood, because they had a better understanding, I should say, because, you know, they'd been talking to her through those 15 years of working for Scientology. Yes. Like, they knew when somebody's parked outside the house, they knew what it was, you know, where we were probably getting followed all the time. I didn't even know.
Yeah.
So she did have a little bit of support like that. But other than that, everything was brand new. She had a little room she ran with a couple guys because she needed to live somewhere, you know, but she had no references for that. I don't even know how she got that. I don't even know how she got what she did. I know she worked really hard for it.
I know she did. She's, like I said, she is a strong, resourceful, talented woman.
She is, for sure.
Who I absolutely adore. It's been wonderful talking to you, Michelle. Is there anything that you feel like you want to say that we haven't covered?
Nothing comes to mind. No, Mike.
All right. Well, I am going to circle back to you at some point in the future, and we're going to talk some more, because I find this fascinating, and I find your perspective fascinating, and I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate your insights, and I appreciate your kind comments and thoughts, and I hope you and Rachel continue to have a wonderful life together.
Thanks. My family appreciates you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in. You can find more episodes of Exposing Scientology wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out my best-selling book, A Billion Years, My Escape from a Life in the Highest Ranks of Scientology. It's available on Amazon, hardback, paperback, and an audiobook. Until next time, be well and happy.